stood on the streets, briefly the owner of a semi-legitimate business, and for most of his life the leader of a hippie commune cut off from the world. He recalled the one regular job he had ever had. At 18, he had gone to work for the Jenkinsons, the couple who ran the liquor store down the street. He had thought of them as old at the time, but now he guessed they had been in their 50s. His intention had been to work just long enough to figure out where they kept their money, then steal it. But then he learned something about himself. He discovered he had a queer talent for arithmetic. Each morning, Mr. Jenkinson put $10 worth of change into the cash register. As customers bought liquor and paid and got change, Priest either served them himself or heard one of the Jenkinsons sing out the total. $1.29, please, Mrs. Roberto. Or $3 even, sir. And the figures seemed to add themselves up in his head. All day long, Priest knew exactly how much money was in the till, and at the end of the day he could tell Mr. Jenkinson the total before he counted it. He would hear Mr. Jenkinson talking to the salesman who called, and he soon knew the wholesale and retail prices of every item in the store. From then on, the automatic register in his brain calculated the profit on every transaction, and he was awestruck by how much the Jenkinsons were making without stealing from anyone. He arranged for them to be robbed 4 times in a month, then made them an offer for the store. When they turned him down, he arranged a 5th robbery and made sure Mrs. Jenkinson got roughed up this time. After that, Mr. Jenkinson accepted his offer. Priest borrowed the deposit from the neighborhood loan shark and paid Mr. Jenkinson the installments out of the store's takings. Although he could not read or write, he always knew his financial position exactly. Nobody could cheat him. One time, he employed a respectable-looking middle-aged woman who stole $1 out of the register every day. At the end of the week, he deducted $5 from her pay, beat her up, and told her not to come back. Within a year, he had 4 stores. 2 years later, he had a wholesale liquor warehouse. After 3 years, he was a millionaire, and at the end of his 4th year, he was on the run. He sometimes wondered what might have happened if he had paid off the loan shark in full, given his accountant honest figures to report to the IRS, and made a plea bargain deal with the LAPD on the fraud charges. Maybe today he would have a company as big as Coca-Cola and be living in one of those mansions in Beverly Hills with a gardener and a pool boy and a 5-car garage. But as he tried to imagine it, he knew it could never have happened. That was not him. The guy who came down the stairs of the mansion in a white bathrobe and coolly ordered the maid to squeeze him a glass of orange juice had someone else's face. Priest could never live in the square world. He had always had a problem with rules. He could never obey other people's. That was why he had to live here. In Silver River Valley, I make the rules, I change the rules, I am the rules. Flower told him her fingers hurt. Then it's time to stop, Priest said. If you like, I'll teach you another song tomorrow. If I'm still alive. Does it hurt you? No, but that's only because I'm used to it. When you practice the guitar a little, your fingertips get hard pads on them. Like the skin on your heel. Does Noel Gallagher have hard pads? If Noel Gallagher is a pop guitarist, of course he's in Oasis. Well, then he has hard pads. Do you think you might like to be a musician?
No.
That was pretty definite. Do you have some other ideas? She looked guilty, as if she knew he was going to disapprove, but she screwed up her courage and said, I want to be a writer. He was not sure how he felt about that. Your daddy will never be able to read your work. But he pretended enthusiasm. That's good. What kind?
For a magazine, like Teen, maybe.
Why?
You get to meet stars and interview them and write about fashions and makeup.
Priest gritted his teeth and tried not to let his revulsion show.
Well, I like the idea that you might be a writer anyway. If you wrote poetry and stories instead of magazine articles, you could still live here in Silver River Valley.
Yeah, maybe, she said doubtfully.
He could see that she was not planning to spend her life here, but she was too young to understand. By the time she was old enough to decide for herself, she would have a different view. I hope. Star came over.
Time for truth, she said.
Priest took the guitar from Flower. Go and get ready for bed now, he said.
This book is continued on Disc 5. Disc 5.
Priest took the guitar from Flower. "Go and get ready for bed now," he said. He and Star headed for the parking circle, dropping off the guitar at Song's cabin on the way. They found Melanie already there, sitting in the back seat of the Cuda, listening to the radio. She had put on a bright yellow T-shirt and blue jeans from the free shop. Both were too big for her, and she had tucked in the T-shirt and pulled the jeans tight with a belt, showing off her tiny waist. She still looked like sex on a stick. John Truth had a flat nasal twang that could become hypnotic. His specialty was saying aloud the things his listeners believed in their hearts but were ashamed to admit to. It was mostly standard fascist pig stuff. AIDS was a punishment for sin. Intelligence was racially inherited. What the world needed was stricter discipline. All politicians were stupid and corrupt and like that. Priest imagined that his audience was mostly the kind of fat white men who learned everything they knew in bars.
"This guy," Starr said, "he's everything I hate about America. Prejudiced, sanctimonious, hypocritical, self-righteous, and really fucking stupid."
"That's a fact," Priest said. "Listen up." Truth was saying,
"I'm going to read once more that statement made by the governor's cabinet secretary, Mr. Honeymoon."
Priest's hackles rose, and Starr said, "That son of a bitch." Honeymoon was the man behind the scheme to flood Silver River Valley, and they hated him. John Truth went on, speaking slowly and ponderously, as if every syllable was significant.
"Listen to this. The FBI has investigated the threat which appeared on an Internet bulletin board on the 1st of May. That investigation has determined that there is no substance to the threat."
Priest's heart sank. This was what he had expected, but all the same he was dismayed. He had hoped for at least some slight hint of appeasement, but Honeymoon sounded completely intractable. Truth carried on reading.
"Governor Mike Robeson, following the FBI's recommendation, has decided to take no further action. That, my friends, is the statement in its entirety."
Truth obviously felt it was outrageously short.
"Are you satisfied? The terrorist deadline runs out tomorrow. Do you feel reassured? Call John Truth on this number now to tell the world what you think."
Priest said, "That means we have to do it." Melanie said, "Well, I never expected the governor to cave in without a demonstration."
"Nor did I guess." He frowned.
"The statement mentioned the FBI twice. It sounds to me like Mike Robeson is getting ready to blame the feds if things go wrong. And that makes me wonder if in his heart he's not so sure."
"So if we give him proof that we really can cause an earthquake,
maybe he'll think again." Star looked downcast.
"Shit," she said. "I guess I'd been hoping we wouldn't have to do this."
Priest was alarmed. He did not want Star to get cold feet at this point. Her support was necessary to carry the rest of the rice eaters.
"We can do this without hurting anyone," he said. "Melanie has picked the perfect location."
He turned to the back seat. "Tell Star what we talked about." Melanie leaned forward and unfolded a map so that Star and Priest could see it. She did not know that Priest could not read maps.
"Here's the Owens Valley Fault," she said, pointing to a red streak. "There were major earthquakes in 1790 and 1872, so another one is overdue."
Star said, "Surely earthquakes don't happen according to a regular timetable."
"No, but the history of the fault shows that enough pressure for an earthquake builds up over about a century, which means we can cause one now if we give a nudge in the right place."
"Which is where?" Star said. Melanie pointed to a spot on the map.
"Round about here."
"You can't be exact?"
"Not until I get there. Michael's data gives us the location within about a mile. When I look at the landscape, I should be able to pinpoint the spot."
"How?"
"Evidence of earlier earthquakes."
"Okay."
"Now, the best time, according to Michael's seismic window, will be between 1:30 and 2:20.
"How can you be sure no one will get hurt?"
Look at the map. Owens Valley is thinly populated, just a few small towns strung along a dried-up riverbed. The point I've chosen is miles from any human habitation.
Priest added, "We can be sure the earthquake will be minor. The effects will hardly be felt in the nearest town."
He knew this was not certain, and so did Melanie, but he gave her a hard stare, and she did not contradict him.
Starr said, "If the effects are hardly felt, no one's going to give a shit, so why do it?"
She was being contrary, but that was just a sign of how tense she was.
Priest said, "We said we would cause an earthquake tomorrow. As soon as we've done it, we'll call John Truth on Melanie's mobile phone and tell him we kept our promise."
What a moment that will be. What a feeling.
Will he believe us?
Melanie said, "He'll have to when he checks the seismograph."
Priest said, "Imagine how Governor Robeson and his people will feel."
He could hear the exultation in his own voice.
"Especially that asshole honeymoon. They'll be like, shit, these people really can cause earthquakes, man. What the fuck we gonna do?"
"And then what?" said Starr.
"Then we threaten to do it again. But this time we don't give them a month, we give them a week."
"How will we make the threat, same way we did before?"
Melanie answered,
"I don't think so. I'm sure they have a way of monitoring the bulletin board and tracing the phone call. And if we use a different bulletin board, there's always the chance that no one will notice our message. Remember, it was 3 weeks before John Truth picked up on our last one."
"So we call and threaten a second earthquake."
Priest put in, "But next time it won't be in a remote wilderness. It'll be someplace where real damage will be done."
He caught an apprehensive look from Starr.
"We don't have to mean it," he added. "Once we've shown our power, just the threat ought to be enough."
Starr said, "Inshallah."
She had picked it up from Poem, who was Algerian.
"If God wills."
It was pitch dark when they left the next morning. The seismic vibrator had not been seen in daylight within 100 miles of the valley, and Priest wanted to keep it that way. He planned to leave home and return in darkness. The round trip would be about 500 miles, 11 hours driving in a truck with a top speed of 45. They would take the CUDA as a backup car, Priest had decided. Oak Tree would come with them to share the driving. Priest used a flashlight to illuminate the way through the trees to where the truck was concealed. The four of them were silent, anxious. It took them half an hour to remove the branches they had piled over the vehicle. He was tense when at last he sat behind the wheel, slid the key into the ignition, and turned on the engine. It started the first time with a satisfying roar, and he felt exultant. The commune's houses were more than a mile away, and he was sure no one would hear the engine at such a distance. The dense forest muffled sound. Later, of course, everyone would notice that four commune members were away. Aneth had been briefed to say they had gone to a vineyard in Napa that Paul Beale wanted them to see, where a new hybrid vine had been planted. It was unusual for people to make trips out of the commune, but there would be few questions, for no one liked to challenge Priest. He turned on the headlights, and Melanie climbed into the truck beside him. He engaged low gear and steered the heavy vehicle through the trees to the dirt track, then turned uphill and headed for the road. The all-terrain tires coped easily with stream beds and mudslides.
"Jesus, I wonder if this is going to work. An earthquake? Come on. But it has to work."
He got on the road and headed east. After 20 minutes, they climbed out of Silver River Valley and hit Route 89. Priest turned south. He checked his mirrors and saw that Starr and Oak Tree were still behind in the CUDA. Beside him, Melanie was very calm. Probing gently, he said, "Was Dusty okay last night?"
"Fine. He likes visiting his father. Michael could always find time for him. Never for me."
Melanie's bitterness was familiar. What surprised Priest was her lack of fear. Unlike him, she was not agonizing over what would happen to her child if she died today. She seemed completely confident that nothing would go wrong, the earthquake would not harm her. Was it that she knew more than Priest? Or was she the type of person who just ignored uncomfortable facts? Priest was not sure.
As dawn broke, they were looping around the north end of Lake Tahoe. The motionless water looked like a disk of polished steel fallen amid the mountains. The seismic vibrator was a conspicuous vehicle on the winding road that followed the pine-fringed shore. But the vacationers were still asleep, and the truck was seen only by a few bleary-eyed workers on their way to jobs in hotels and restaurants. By sunup, we were on U.S. 395, across the border in Nevada, bowling south through a flat desert landscape. They took a break at a truck stop, parking the seismic vibrator where it could not be seen from the road, and ate a breakfast of oily western omelets and watery coffee. When the road swung back into California, it climbed into the mountains, and for a couple of hours the scenery was majestic, with steep forested slopes, a grander version of Silver River Valley. They dropped down again beside a silvery sea that Melanie said was Mono Lake. Soon afterward, they were on a two-lane road that cut a straight line down a long, dusty valley. The valley widened until the mountains on the far side were just a blue haze, then it narrowed again. The ground on either side of the road was tan-colored and stony, with a scattering of low brush. There was no river, but the salt flats looked like a distant sheet of water. Melanie said, "This is Owens Valley." The landscape gave Priest the feeling that some kind of disaster had blighted it. "What happened here?" he said. "The river is dry because the water was diverted to Los Angeles years ago." They passed through a sleepy small town every 20 miles or so. Now there was no way to be inconspicuous. There was little traffic, and the seismic vibrator was stared at every time they waited at a stoplight. Plenty of men would remember it. "Yeah, I seen that rig. Looked like she might be for laying blacktop or something. What was she, anyway?" Melanie switched on her laptop and unfolded her map. She said musingly, "Somewhere beneath us, two vast slabs of the Earth's crust are wedged together, stuck, straining to spring free." The thought made Priest feel cold. He could hardly believe he aimed to release all that pent-up destructive force. "I must be out of my mind." "Somewhere in the next 5 or 10 miles," she said. "What's the time?" "Just after 1. They had cut it fine. The seismic window would open in half an hour and close 50 minutes later. Melanie directed Priest down a side turning that crossed the flat valley floor. It was not really a road, just a track cleared through the boulders and scrub. Although the ground seemed almost level, the main road disappeared from view behind them, and they could see only the tops of high trucks passing. "Pull up here," Melanie said at last. Priest stopped the truck, and they both got out. The sun beat down on them from a merciless sky. The Cuda pulled up behind them, and Star and Oak Tree got out, stretching their arms and legs after the long drive. "Look at that," Melanie said. "See the dry gulch?" Priest could see where a stream, long ago dried up, had cut a channel through the rocky ground. But where Melanie was pointing, the gulch came to an abrupt end, as if it had been walled off. "That's strange," Priest said. "Now look a few yards to the right." Priest followed her moving finger. The stream bed began again just as abruptly and continued toward the middle of the valley. Priest realized what she was pointing out. "That's the fault line," he said. "Last time there was an earthquake, one whole side of this valley picked up its skirts and shifted 5 yards, then sat down again." "That's about it," Oak Tree said. "And we're about to make it happen again, is that right?" There was a note of awe in his voice. "We're going to try," Priest said briskly. "And we don't have much time." He turned to Melanie. "Is the truck in exactly the right place?" "I guess," she said. "A few yards one way or another up here on the surface shouldn't make any difference 5 miles down." "Okay." He hesitated. He almost felt he ought to make a speech. He said, "Well, I'll get started." He got into the cabin of the truck and settled into the driver's seat, then started the engine that ran the vibrator. He threw the switch that lowered the steel plate to the ground. He set the vibrator to shake for 30 seconds in the middle of its frequency range. He looked through the rear window of the cab and checked the gauges. The readouts were normal. He picked up the remote radio controller and got out of the truck. "All set," he said. The four of them got into the Cuda. Oak Tree took the wheel. They drove back to the road, crossed it, and headed into the scrub on the far side. They went partway up the hillside. Then Melanie said, "This is fine." Oak Tree stopped the car. Priest hoped they were not conspicuous from the road. If they were, there was nothing he could do about it. But the muddy colors of the Cuda's paint job blended into the brown landscape. Oak Tree said nervously, "Is this far enough away?"
"I think so,"
Melanie said coolly. She was not scared at all. Studying her face, Priest saw a hint of mad excitement in her eyes. It was almost sexual. Was she taking her revenge on the seismologists who had rejected her, or the husband who had let her down, or the whole damn world? Whatever the explanation, she was getting a big charge out of this. They got out and stood looking across the valley. They could just see the top of the truck. Star said to Priest, "It was a mistake for both of us to come. If we die, Flower has no one." "She has the whole commune," Priest said. "You and I are not the only adults she loves and trusts. We're not a nuclear family, and that's one very good reason why." Melanie looked annoyed. "We're a quarter of a mile from the fault, assuming it runs along the valley floor," she said in a cut-the-crap tone of voice. "We'll feel the earth move, but we're not in any danger. People who are hurt in earthquakes generally get hit by parts of buildings. Falling ceilings, bridges that collapse, flying glass, stuff like that. We're safe here." Star looked over her shoulder. "The mountain isn't going to fall on us?"
"It might, and we might all be killed in a car wreck driving back to Silver River Valley. But it's so unlikely that we shouldn't waste time worrying about it."
"That's easy for you to say. Your child's father is 300 miles away in San Francisco." Priest said, "I don't care if I die here. I can't raise my children in suburban America." Oak Tree muttered, "This has to work. This just has to work." Melanie said, "For God's sake, Priest, we don't have all day. Just press the damn button." Priest looked up and down the road and waited for a dark green Jeep Grand Cherokee Limited to pass. "Okay," he said when the road was clear. "This is it." He pressed the button on the remote control. He heard the roar of the vibrator immediately, though it was muted by distance. He felt the vibration in the soles of his feet, a faint but definite trembling sensation. Star said, "Oh, God!" A cloud of dust billowed around the truck. All four of them were taut as guitar strings, their bodies tensed for the first hint of movement in the earth. Seconds passed. Priest's eyes raked the landscape, looking for signs of a tremor, though he guessed he would feel it before he saw it. "Come on, come on." The seismic exploration crews normally set the vibrator for a 7-second sweep. Priest had set this one for 30 seconds. It seemed like an hour. At last the noise stopped. Melanie said, "God damn it." Priest's heart sank. There was no earthquake. It had failed. Maybe it was just a crazy hippie idea, like levitating the Pentagon.
"Try it again," said Melanie.
Priest looked at the remote control in his hand. "Why not?" There was a 16-wheel truck approaching along U.S. 395, but this time Priest did not wait. If Melanie was right, the truck would be unaffected by the tremor. If Melanie was wrong, they would all be dead. He pressed the button. The distant roar started up, there was a perceptible vibration in the ground, and a cloud of dust engulfed the seismic vibrator. Priest wondered if the road would open up under the 16-wheeler. Nothing happened. The 30 seconds passed more quickly this time. Priest was surprised when the noise stopped. Is that all? Despair engulfed him. Perhaps the Silver River Valley Commune was a dream that had come to an end. What am I going to do? Where will I live? How can I avoid ending up like bones? But Melanie was not ready to give up. "Let's move the truck a ways and try again." "But you said the exact position doesn't matter," Oak Tree pointed out. "A few yards one way or another up here on the surface shouldn't make any difference 5 miles down. That's what you said."
"Then we'll move it more than a few yards," Melanie said angrily. "We're running out of time. Let's go."
Priest did not argue with her. She was transformed.
Normally, she was dominated by Priest. She was a damsel in distress. He had rescued her, and she was so grateful she had to be eternally submissive to his will. But now she was in charge, impatient and domineering. Priest could put up with that as long as she could do what she had promised. He would bring her back into line later. They got into the Cuda and drove fast across the baked earth to the seismic vibrator. Then Priest and Melanie climbed into the cab of the truck, and she directed him as he drove, while Oak Tree and Star followed in the car. They were no longer following the track, but cutting straight through the brush. The truck's big wheels crushed the scrubby bushes and rolled easily over the stones, but Priest wondered if the low-slung Cuda would suffer damage. He guessed Oak Tree would honk if he had trouble. Melanie scanned the landscape for the telltale features that showed where the fault line ran. Priest saw no more displaced stream beds, but after half a mile Melanie pointed at what looked like a miniature cliff about 4 feet high. "Fault scarp," she said, "about 100 years old." "I see it," Priest said. There was a dip in the ground like a bowl, and a break in the rim of the bowl showed where the earth had moved sideways, as if the bowl had cracked and been glued together clumsily. Melanie said, "Let's try here." Priest stopped the truck and lowered the plate. Swiftly, he rechecked the gauges and set the vibrator. This time, he programmed a 60-second sweep. When all was set, he jumped out of the truck. He checked his watch anxiously. It was 2 o'clock. They had only 20 minutes left. Again, they drove the Cuda across U.S. 395 and up the hill on the far side. The drivers of the few vehicles that passed continued to ignore them, but Priest was nervous. Sooner or later, someone would ask what they were doing. He did not want to have to explain himself to a curious cop or a nosy town councilman. He had a plausible story ready about a university research project on the geology of the dried-up riverbed, but he did not want anyone to remember his face. They all got out of the car and looked across the valley to where the seismic vibrator stood near the scarp. Priest wished with all his heart that this time he would see the earth move and open. "Come on, God, give me this one, okay?" He pressed the button. The truck roared, the earth trembled faintly, and the dust rose. The vibration went on for a full minute instead of half. But there was no earthquake. They just waited longer for disappointment. When the noise died away, Star said, "This isn't going to work, is it?" Melanie threw her a furious look. Turning to Priest, she said, "Can you alter the frequency of the vibrations?" "Yes," Priest said. "Right now it's set near the middle, so I can go up or down. Why?"
"There's a theory that pitch may be a crucial factor. See, the earth is constantly resounding with faint vibrations. So why aren't there earthquakes all the time? Maybe because a vibration has to be just the right pitch to dislodge the fault. You know how a musical note can shatter a glass?"
"I never saw it happen except in a cartoon, but I know what you mean."
"The answer is yes. When they use the vibrator in seismic exploration, they vary the pitch over a 7-second sweep."
"They do?" Melanie was curious. "Why?"
"I don't know. Maybe it gives them a better reading on the geophones. Anyway, it didn't seem the right thing for us, so I didn't select that feature, but I can."
"Let's try it."
"Okay, but we need to hurry. It's already 2:05. They jumped into the car. Oak Tree drove fast, skidding across the dusty desert. Priest reset the controls of the vibrator for a sweep of gradually increasing pitch over a period of 60 seconds. As they raced back to their observation point, he checked his watch again. 2:15, he said. "This is our last chance."
"Don't worry," Melanie said. "I'm out of ideas. If this doesn't work, I'm giving up."
Oak Tree stopped the car, and they got out again. The thought of driving all the way back to Silver River with nothing to celebrate depressed Priest so profoundly that he felt he would want to crash the truck on the freeway and end it all. Maybe that was his way out. He wondered if Star would like to die with him. "I can see it now, the two of us, an overdose of painkillers, a bottle of wine to wash down the pills."
"What are you waiting for?" said Melanie. "It's 2:20. Press the damn button."
Priest pressed the button. As before, the truck roared and the ground trembled and a cloud of dust rose from the earth around the pounding steel plate of the vibrator. This time the roar did not stay at the same moderate pitch, but started at a profound bass rumble and began slowly to climb.
Then it happened. The earth beneath Priest's feet seemed to ripple like a choppy sea. Then he felt as if someone took him by the leg and threw him down. He landed flat on his back, hitting the ground hard. It knocked the wind out of him. Star and Melanie screamed at the same time, Melanie with a high-pitched shriek, and Star with a roar of shock and fright. Priest saw them both fall, Melanie next to him and Star a few steps away. Oaktree staggered, stayed on his feet, and fell last. Priest was silently terrified. "I've had it. This is it. I'm going to die." There was a noise like an express train thundering past close by. Dust rose from the ground, small stones flew through the air, and boulders rolled every which way. The ground continued to move as if someone had hold of the end of a rug and would not stop shaking it. The feeling was unbelievably disorienting, as if the world had suddenly become a completely strange place. It was terrifying. "I'm not ready to die." Priest caught his breath and struggled to his knees. Then, as he got one foot flat on the ground, Melanie grabbed his arm and pulled him down again. He screamed at her, "Let me go, you dumb cunt!" But he could not hear his own words. The ground heaved up and threw him downhill, away from the CUDA. Melanie fell on top of him. He thought the car might turn over and crush both of them, and he tried to roll out of its path. He could not see Star or Oaktree. A flying thorn bush whipped his face, scratching him. Dust got into his eyes, and he was momentarily blinded. He lost all sense of direction. He curled up in a ball, covering his face with his arms, and waited for death. "Christ, if I'm going to die, I wish I could die with Star." The shaking stopped as suddenly as it had started. He had no idea whether it had lasted 10 seconds or 10 minutes. A moment later, the noise died away. Priest rubbed the dust out of his eyes and stood up. His vision cleared slowly. He saw Melanie at his feet. He extended a hand and pulled her up. "Are you okay?" he said.
"I think so," she replied shakily.
The dust in the air thinned, and he saw Oaktree getting to his feet unsteadily. Where was Star? Then he saw her a few steps away. She lay on her back with her eyes closed. His heart lurched. Not dead. Please, God, not dead. He knelt by her side. "Star," he said urgently, "are you okay?" She opened her eyes.
"Jesus," she said.
"That was a blast." Priest grinned, fighting back tears of relief. He helped Star to her feet. "We're all alive," he said. The dust was settling fast. He looked across the valley and saw the truck. It was upright and seemed undamaged. A few yards from it, there was a great gash in the ground that ran north and south in the middle of the valley as far as he could see. "Well, I'll be darned," he said quietly. "Look at that."
"It worked," said Melanie.
"We did it," Oaktree said. "God damn it, we caused a motherfucking earthquake." Priest grinned at them all.
"That's the truth," he said.
He kissed Star, then Melanie, then Oaktree kissed them both, then Star kissed Melanie. They all laughed. Then Priest started to dance. He did a Red Indian war hop, there in the middle of the broken valley, his boots kicking up the newly settled dust. Star joined in, then Melanie and Oaktree, and the four of them went round and round in a circle, shouting and whooping and laughing, until the tears came to their eyes. Part 2. 7 days. Chapter 8. Judy Maddox was driving home on Friday at the end of the worst week in her FBI career. She could not figure out what she had done to deserve this. Okay, she had yelled at her boss, but he had been hostile to her before she blew her cool, so there had to be another reason. She had gone to Sacramento yesterday with every intention of making the Bureau look efficient and competent, and somehow she had ended up giving an impression of muddle and impotence. She felt frustrated and depressed. Nothing good had happened since her meeting with Al Honeymoon. She had been calling seismology professors and interviewing them by phone. She would ask whether the professor was working on locations of critically stressed points on fault lines. If so, who had access to their data? And did any of those people have connections with terrorist groups? The seismologists had not been helpful.
Most of today's academics had been students in the 60s and 70s, when the FBI had paid every creep on campus to spy on the protest movement. It was a long time ago, but they had not forgotten. To them, the Bureau was the enemy. Judy understood how they felt, but she wished they would not be passive-aggressive with agents who were working in the public interest. The Hammer of Eden's deadline ran out today, and there had been no earthquake. Judy was deeply relieved, even though it suggested she had been wrong to take the threat seriously. Maybe this would be the end of the whole thing. She told herself she should have a relaxing weekend. The weather was great, sunny and warm. Tonight she would make stir-fried chicken for Beau and open a bottle of wine. Tomorrow she would have to go to the supermarket, but on Sunday she could drive up the coast to Bodega Bay and sit on the beach reading a book like a normal person. On Monday she would probably be given a new assignment. Maybe she could make a fresh start. She wondered whether to call her girlfriend Virginia and see if she wanted to go to the beach. Jenny was her oldest friend, also the daughter of a cop, and the same age as Judy, she was sales director of a security firm. But Judy realized it was not feminine company she wanted. It would be nice to lie on the beach beside something with hairy legs and a deep voice. It was a year since she had split up with Don. This was the longest time she had been without a lover since her teens. At college she had been a little wild, almost promiscuous. Working at Mutual American Insurance, she had had an affair with her boss. Then she had lived with Steve Dolan for 7 years and almost married him. She often thought about Steve. He was attractive and smart and kind. Too kind, maybe, for in the end she came to think of him as weak. Maybe she asked the impossible. Perhaps all considerate, attentive men were weak, and all the strong ones, like Don Riley, ended up stooping their secretaries. Her car phone rang. She did not need to pick up the handset. After two rings, it connected automatically in hands-free mode. "Hello," she said. "This is Judy Maddox." "This is your father." "Hi, Beau. Will you be home for supper? We could have..." He interrupted her. "Turn on your car radio, quick," he said. "Tune to John Truth." Christ, what now? She touched the power switch. A rock music station came on. She jabbed at a preset button and got the San Francisco station that broadcast John Truth live. His nasal twang filled the car. He was speaking in the ponderously dramatic manner he used to suggest that what he had to say was world-shakingly important. "The California state seismologist has now confirmed that there was an earthquake today, the very day the Hammer of Eden promised it. It took place at 2:20 p.m. in Owens Valley, just as the Hammer of Eden said when they called this show a few minutes ago." My God, they did it. Judy was electrified. She forgot her frustration, and her depression vanished. She felt alive again. John Truth was saying, "But the same state seismologist denied that this or any other earthquake could have been caused by a terrorist group." Was that true? Judy had to know. What did other seismologists think? She needed to make some calls. Then she heard John Truth say, "In a moment we will play you a recording of the message left by the Hammer of Eden." They're on tape. That could be a crucial mistake by the terrorists. They would not know it, but a voice on tape would provide a mass of information when analyzed by Simon Sparrow. Truth went on, "Meanwhile, what do you think? Do you believe the state seismologist? Or do you think he's whistling past the graveyard? Maybe you are a seismologist and you have an opinion on the technical possibilities here. Or maybe you're just a concerned citizen and you think the authorities ought to be as worried as you are. Call John Truth Live on this number now to tell the world what you think." A commercial for a furniture warehouse came on and Judy muted the volume. "Are you still there, Beau?"
"Sure."
"They did it, didn't they?"
"Sure looks like it."
She wondered whether he was genuinely uncertain or just being cautious. "What does your instinct say?" He gave her another ambiguous answer.
"That these people are very dangerous."
Judy tried to calm her racing heart and turn her mind to what she should do next. "I'd better call Brian Kincaid."
"What are you going to tell him?"
"The news."
Wait a minute. Beau was making a point. You don't think I should call him?
I think you should call your boss when you can give him something he can't get from the radio.
You're right.
Judy began to feel calmer as she ran over the possibilities. I guess I'm going back to work.
She made a right turn.
Okay, I'll be home in an hour or so. Call me if you want supper.
She felt a sudden rush of affection for him.
Thanks, Beau. You're a great daddy.
He laughed. You're a great kid, too. Later.
Later.
She touched the button that terminated the call, then she turned up the volume on the radio. She heard a low, sexy voice saying, "This is the Hammer of Eden with a message for Governor Mike Robeson." The picture that came into her mind was of a mature woman with large breasts and a wide smile, likable, but kind of off the wall.
"That's my enemy?"
The tone changed, and the woman muttered, "Shit, I didn't expect to be talking to a tape recorder." She's not the organizational brain behind all this. She's too ditzy. She's taking instructions from someone else. The woman resumed her formal voice and continued, "Like we promised, we caused an earthquake today, 4 weeks after our last message. It happened in Owens Valley a little after 2 o'clock. You can check it out." A faint background noise caused her to hesitate. What was that? Simon will find out. A second later, she carried on. "We do not recognize the jurisdiction of the United States government. Now that you know we can do what we say, you'd better think again about our demand. Announce a freeze on construction of new power plants in California. You have 7 days to make up your mind."
7 days? Last time they gave us 4 weeks.
"After that, we will trigger another earthquake, but the next one won't be out in the middle of nowhere. If you force us, we'll do real damage."
A carefully calculated escalation of the threat. Jesus, these people scare me.
"We don't like it, but it's the only way. Please do as we say so that this nightmare can end."
John Truth came on.
"There it is, the voice of the Hammer of Eden, the group that claims to have triggered the earthquake that shook Owens Valley today."
Judy had to have that tape. She turned down the volume again and dialed Raj's home number. He was single. He could give up his Friday evening. When he answered, she said, "Hi, this is Judy." He said immediately, "I can't. I have tickets for the opera."
She hesitated, then decided to play along.
"What's on?"
Macbeth's wedding."
She suppressed a laugh.
"By Ludwig Sebastian Wagner?"
"Right."
"No such opera, no such composer. You're working tonight."
"Shit."
"Why didn't you invent a rock group? I would have believed you."
"I keep forgetting how old you are."
She laughed. Roger was 26, Judy was 36.
"I'll take that as a compliment. What's the assignment?"
He did not sound too reluctant. Judy became serious again.
"Okay, here it is. There was an earthquake in the eastern part of the state this afternoon, and the Hammer of Eden claim they triggered it."
"Wow, maybe these people are for real after all."
He sounded pleased rather than scared. He was young and keen, and he had not thought through the implications.
"John Truth just played a recorded message from the perpetrators. I need you to go to the radio station and get the tape."
"I'm on my way."
"Make sure you get the original, not a copy. If they give you a hard time, tell them we can get a court order in an hour."
"Nobody gives me a hard time. This is Raja, remember?"
It was true. He was a charmer.
"Take the tape to Simon Sparrow and tell him I need something in the morning."
"You got it."
She broke the connection and turned John Truth up again. He was saying,
"A minor earthquake, by the way, magnitude 5 to 6.
How the hell did they do it?
"No one injured, no damage to buildings or other property, but a tremor that was quite definitely felt by the residents of Bishop, Big Pine, Independence, and Lone Pine."
Some of those people must have seen the perpetrators within the last few hours, Judy realized. She had to get over there and start interviewing them as soon as possible. Where exactly was the earthquake? She needed to talk to an expert. The obvious choice was the state seismologist. However, he seemed to have a closed mind. He had already ruled out the possibility of a human-made earthquake. That bothered her. She wanted someone who was willing to entertain all possibilities. She thought of Michael Quirkus. He could be a pain in the ass, but he was not afraid to speculate. Plus, he was just across the bay in Berkeley, whereas the state seismologist was in Sacramento. If she showed up without an appointment, he would refuse to see her. She sighed and dialed his number. For a while, there was no answer, and she thought he must be out. He picked up after 6 rings. Quirkus! He sounded annoyed at the interruption.
This is Judy Maddox from the FBI. I need to talk to you. It's urgent, and I'd like to come to your place right away.
It's out of the question. I'm with someone.
I might have known you'd be difficult. Maybe after your meeting is over?
It's not a meeting, and it won't be over till Sunday.
Yeah, right. He had a woman there, Judy guessed. But he had told her at the first meeting that he was not seeing anyone. For some reason, she remembered his exact words. I'm separated from my wife, and I don't have a girlfriend. Perhaps he had lied, or perhaps this was someone new. It did not sound like a new relationship if he was expecting her to stay the weekend. On the other hand, he was arrogant enough to assume that a girl would go to bed with him on the first date, and attractive enough that lots of girls probably would.
I don't know why I'm so interested in his love life.
Have you been listening to the radio? She asked him. There's been an earthquake, and the terrorist group we talked about claims to have triggered it.
Is that so?
He sounded intrigued, despite himself.
Are they telling the truth?
That's what I need to discuss with you.
I see.
Come on, you stubborn son of a gun, give in for once in your life.
This is really important, Professor.
I'd like to help you, but it's really not possible tonight.
No, wait.
His voice became muffled as he covered the mouthpiece with his hand, but she could still distinguish his words.
Hey, have you ever met a real live FBI agent?
She could not hear the reply, but after a moment he said to her,
Okay, my guest would like to meet you. Come on over.
She did not like the idea of being paraded like some kind of circus freak, but at this point she was not going to say so.
Thanks, I'll be there in 20 minutes.
She broke the connection. As she drove over the bridge, she reflected that neither Roger nor Michael had seemed scared. Roger was excited, Michael intrigued. She, too, was electrified by the sudden reanimation of the case. But when she remembered the earthquake of 1989 and the television pictures of rescue workers bringing corpses out of the collapsed double-deck Nimitz Freeway right here in Oakland, and she contemplated the possibility of a terrorist group having the power to do that, her heart felt cold and heavy with foreboding. To clear her mind, she tried to guess what Michael Quirkus's girlfriend would be like. She had seen a picture of his wife, a striking redhead with a supermodel figure and a sulky pout. He seems to like the exotic. But they had broken up, so perhaps she was not really his type. Judy could see him with a woman professor in fashionable, thin-framed spectacles, with well-cut short hair but no makeup. On the other hand, that type of woman would not cross the street to meet an FBI agent. Most likely he had picked up a sexy airhead who was easily impressed. Judy visualized a girl in tight clothes, smoking and chewing gum at the same time, looking around his apartment and saying, "Have you read all these books?"
I don't know why I'm obsessing about his girlfriend when I've got so much else to worry about.
She found Euclid Street and parked under the same magnolia tree as last time. She rang his bell and he buzzed her into the building. He came to the apartment door barefoot, looking pleasantly weekendish in blue jeans and a white T-shirt. A girl could have fun spending the weekend fooling around with him. She followed him into his office cum living room. There, to her astonishment, she saw a little boy of about 5, with freckles and fair hair, dressed in pajamas with dinosaurs all over them. After a moment, she recognized him as the child in the photograph on the desk. Michael's son. This was his weekend guest. She felt embarrassed about the dumb blonde she had imagined.
I was a little unfair to you, Professor.
Michael said, Dusty, meet Special Agent Judy Maddox. The boy shook hands politely and said,
Are you really in the FBI?
Yes, I am.
Wow.
Want to see my badge? She took her shield from her shoulder bag and gave it to him. He held it reverently. Michael said, "Dusty likes to watch the X-Files." Judy smiled. "I don't work in the alien spacecraft department. I just catch regular Earth criminals." Dusty said, "Can I see your gun?" Judy hesitated. She knew that boys were fascinated by weapons, but she did not like to encourage such an interest. She glanced at Michael, who shrugged. She unbuttoned her jacket and took the weapon out of its shoulder holster. As she did so, she caught Michael looking at her breasts, and she felt a sudden sexual frisson. Now that he was not being curmudgeonly, he was kind of appealing, with his bare feet and his T-shirt untucked. She said, "Guns are pretty dangerous, Dusty, so I'm going to hold it, but you can look." Dusty's face, as he stared at the pistol, wore the same expression as Michael's when she opened her jacket. The thought made her grin. After a minute, she holstered the gun. Dusty said with elaborate politeness, "We were just going to have some Cap'n Crunch. Would you care to join us?" Judy was impatient to question Michael, but she sensed he would be more forthcoming if she was patient and played along. "How nice of you," she said. "I'm real hungry. I'd love some Cap'n Crunch." "Come into the kitchen." The three of them sat at a plastic-topped table in the little kitchen and ate breakfast cereal and milk out of bright blue pottery bowls. Judy realized she was hungry. It was past supper time. "My goodness," she said, "I'd forgotten how good Cap'n Crunch is." Michael laughed. Judy was amazed at the difference in him. He was relaxed and amiable. He seemed a different person from the grouch who had forced her to drive back to the office and phone him for an appointment. She was beginning to like him. When supper was eaten, Michael got Dusty ready for bed. Dusty said to his father, "Can Agent Judy tell me a story?" Judy suppressed her impatience. "I've got 7 days. I can wait another 5 minutes." She said, "I think your daddy wants to tell you a story, because he doesn't get to do it as often as he'd like." "It's okay," Michael said with a smile. "I'll listen in." They went into the bedroom. "I don't know many stories, but I remember one my mommy used to tell me," Judy said. "It's the legend of the kindly dragon. Would you like to hear it?"
"Yes, please," said Dusty.
"Me too," said Michael.
"Once upon a time, a long, long time ago, there was a kindly dragon who lived in China, where all dragons come from. One day the kindly dragon went wandering. He wandered so far that he left China and got lost in the wilderness. After many days he came to another land, far to the south. It was the most beautiful country he had ever seen, with forests and mountains and fertile valleys and rivers for him to splash about in. There were banana palms and mulberry trees laden with ripe fruit. The weather was always warm with a pleasant breeze. But there was one thing wrong. It was an empty land. No one lived there, no people, and no dragons. So, although the kindly dragon loved the new land, he was terribly lonely. However, he didn't know the way home, so he roamed all around looking for someone to keep him company. At last, one lucky day, he found the one person who lived there, a fairy princess. She was so beautiful that he fell in love with her at once. Now, the princess was lonely, too, and although the dragon looked fearsome, he had a kind heart, and so she married him. The kindly dragon and the fairy princess loved each other, and they had 100 children. All the children were brave and kindly like their dragon father, and beautiful like their fairy mother. The kindly dragon and the fairy princess looked after their children until they were all grown up. Then, suddenly, both parents vanished. They went away to live in love and harmony in the spirit world for all eternity. And their children became the brave, kindly, beautiful people of Vietnam. And that's where my mommy came from." Dusty was wide-eyed. "Is it true?"
Judy smiled.
"I don't know. Maybe."
"It's a beautiful story anyway," Michael said. He kissed Dusty goodnight. As Judy left the room, she heard Dusty whisper,
"She's really nice, isn't she?"
"Yes," Michael replied. Back in the living room, Michael said, "Thank you for that. You were great with him."
"It wasn't difficult. He's a charmer."
Michael nodded. "Gets it from his mother." Judy smiled.
Michael grinned and said, "I notice you don't argue with that."
"I've never met your wife. In the picture, she looks very beautiful."
"She is. And faithless." That was an unexpected confidence, coming so suddenly from a man she took to be proud. She warmed to him, but she did not know what to say in reply. They were both silent for a moment. Then Michael said, "You've had enough of the Quercus family. Tell me about the earthquake." "At last." "It took place in Owens Valley this afternoon at 2:20. "Let's get the seismograph." Michael sat at his desk and tapped the keys of his computer. She found herself looking at his bare feet. Some men had ugly feet, but his were well-shaped and strong-looking, with neatly clipped toenails. The skin was white, and there was a small tuft of dark hair on each big toe. He did not notice her scrutiny. "When your terrorists made their threat 4 weeks ago, did they specify the location?"
"No."
"Hmm. In the scientific community, we say that a successful earthquake forecast would have to specify date, location, and magnitude. Your people only gave the date. That's not very convincing. There's an earthquake somewhere in California, more or less every day. Maybe they just claimed responsibility for something that happened naturally."
"Can you tell me exactly where today's tremor took place?"
"Yes, I can calculate the epicenter by triangulation."